So modern day MRI imaging of the brain actually shows something extremely fascinating. The MRI images have proven that when a person undergoes trauma, the verbal speech center of the brain shuts down. And they have found that it is only through reactivating those verbal centers through talking about it, which I think a lot of us know from experience, but now we've actually proven it scientifically, that's the only way to get over a trauma, by reactivating the verbal centers, because the trauma has shut them down. So in order to reactivate and heal from that trauma, we really have to start talking. What I found really fascinating is that we really didn't need to wait for modern-day MRI imaging to find this out, even though, like I said, we knew it even just experientially, especially us as women. But if you turn to source number one, the wisest man of all time, Shlomo HaMelech, tells us this in Sefer Mishlei. In Perek Yud Bet Pasuk Chaf Hei, Shlomo HaMelech says, De'aga believe ish yashchena. A worry, anxiety, we can put in trauma here because usually worry and anxiety stems from that trauma. A worry or anxiety in the heart of a man kind of weighs upon the man, right? And we all know this. We've all experienced it, whether from like minor traumas to major traumas. Trauma can weigh us down. How can we fix it? V'davar tov yisamchana. A good word can make that person happy again. And I believe that there are two ways of understanding this last phrase. I believe that the way that he meant it was that when someone speaks a good word to the traumatized person, that person has the power to make him happy again, to lift him out of his downed spirits. But I believe that based on what we just said, it's not only a devar tov from another person, it can also be a devar tov from oneself. When one speaks through it, when one speaks about it, that can help that weight be lifted from one's shoulders. And so I think that in this pasuk, we really see this double entendre, which we know is true in both ways. When a person feels weighed down from a traumatic experience, he or she can either speak through it to someone else, and usually in so doing, there's a conversation, that person responds. And those dvarim tovim, those good words, can really make the person happy again. I'm sure that many of us have been in both sides of the situations, on the side that we've undergone that traumatizing experience, but also when our friend is crying on our shoulder, whether that's literally or figuratively, and we're expected to give them that devar tov, to know that magical word or phrase or, you know, those lines to say that'll poof and make them feel better. I don't know about you, but I used to be very, very intimidated by that role. And, you know, my friends did often call me to, you know, talk about their problems and, you know, going back to high school and college and dating and marriage. And there are lots of times when life hits us in the wrong way or in the way that we didn't expect, and we need a friend. And sometimes we feel a lot of pressure to say the right thing, right? To say that, like I said, magical formula that'll make them feel better. And I think sometimes it weighs on us so much that, you know, we don't even know what to say, and it can be really hard. And so this is where that article that you found, Lisa, this is one of my most favorite articles that I've ever read. And I think for me, it was life changing. Oh, no. Oh, my God. Sorry. Sorry, you just contribute too much. I should have let it go. It was all from Lisa. No, I have to be honest. I don't know. I don't even remember how I found it, but I used this when I was a single, I guess I was dating Aaron, when I was teaching in SKA. They have these, the academy should do this, but there's no, I don't know, maybe TI girls. We had, when I was a senior for the first time, we had these young college girls who usually wanted to go into chinuch and become teachers. They would come in, and every senior had a Friday period dedicated to this informal education, where this young college girl would come in and basically teach the class. But it wasn't really teaching, it was hanging out, and it was really bringing inspirational stories, you know, thought-provoking articles, and we would discuss them. And then I became a chabura teacher myself. We called it chabura. I became a chabura teacher myself, and it was that year, it must have been 2003, 2004, I somehow came across this article. I don't know how old it is. It could have been from the 1990s. But it is as relevant today as it was then.
Yes. And the Rabbit Brand also had a Reader's Digest article.
Oh, that's hilarious. Right? Really?
Yeah.
We didn't talk. Yeah. That's so funny. Yeah. Okay. So just so that you don't hear.
Reader's Digest is my go-to.
I was going to say, if anyone ever needs something.
Second time.
This article is called Lend an Ear. And so that you guys don't hear my voice the entire time, do you mind if we just go around the table, everyone reads a paragraph?
Again.
Is that okay? Aliza.
Is that what you did?
Okay. Yes. 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 I promise we didn't talk.
And I do not
talk. I'm going to put you on the spot, but now you have a chance to, like, preview it. It's okay. It's like they're all like two lines. And it's okay if it's not your native language, then we'll excuse you for any mistakes.
She did a great job.
Even if it is your native language.
Really hard words, Karen. I don't even know what they meant.
I don't know. Okay, Aliza.
Okay, my in-laws had just returned from a harrowing drive back to New York City after wintering in Florida. The first time the car broke down, we were somewhere in North Carolina. My mother-in-law told me over the phone, we had it fixed, and then it stalled again in Delaware. But the worst was on the Verrazano Bridge during rush hour. It seemed as if we'd never get it.
That sounds horrible, I said, ready to launch into my own horror story. A car that conked out at 9:30 p.m. in a deserted mall parking lot.
But someone knocked at her door, so she had to say goodbye. Thank you for listening, she added, but thank you most of all for not telling me your worst car story.
My cheeks burning, I hung up. In the days ahead, I found myself thinking about the wisdom of her parting words.
I can't count the number of times I've begun to complain about a fight with my son, a professional disappointment, or even car problems, only to have my friend cut me off with, the same thing just happened to me.
Suddenly, we're talking about her ungrateful kid, her lousy boss, her leaky fuel line, and I'm left nodding my head in all the right places, wondering if we haven't all come down with a bad case of emotional attention deficit disorder.
It's easy to see how this version of empathy, I know just how you feel and I can prove it, gets confused with the real thing. Nothing's more natural than trying to soothe an overwrought friend with assurance that she's not alone.
But calamities resemble one another only from afar. Up close, they're as unique as fingerprints. Your friend's husband may have been downside out of a job just like your own, but no two families have identical bank accounts, severance packages, or backup plans.
Saying to fill your pain also can be rude to offering advice. Here's what I did, and here's what you should do. But when a car trip takes three times as long as it should, or your child runs a high fever in the middle of the night, do you really want to hear how your friend coped with a similar situation?
What we all hope for when we are feeling low or agitated or wildly happy is to find a friend who sounds like she has all the time in the world to listen. This ability to be with someone in her pain or happiness is a cornerstone of genuine empathy.
Fortunately, empathy is eminently easy to learn. Ever since the conversation with my mother-in-law, for example, I squelched my impulse to interrupt a friend when she confided in me. I'm learning to follow the other person's lead, paying attention to body language, facial expressions, tone of voice, and what's left unsaid.
I'm also more likely to recognize and appreciate empathy when I'm the beneficiary. The other day, I called a friend to complain that I was feeling nervous and couldn't concentrate. Want to tell me about it, she offered, so I rambled on for a while.
Finally, I thanked her for listening and asked how she was feeling. We can talk about me tomorrow, she said. Now that's empathy.
We don't always want answers. Sometimes we just want company.
What do you guys think?
I love that. Yeah.
It's really powerful, right? The first time I read it, I was like, oh, right, I do that all the time, right? My friend tells me something, I'm like, oh, yeah, that happened to me too, and then I go out about myself, and only when I read this article did I realize, well, that's pretty selfish of me, right? I'm talking about myself when she really wants to complain about something that's going on in her life. I just found it really interesting that we really, and I acknowledge that sometimes it is helpful. Sometimes it is helpful to know we're not the only ones in the situation. Sometimes it is helpful to know how our friend dealt with something similar, but often we just want to be validated, right? We just want someone else to hear us. We want to get it off our chest. Like the MRI imaging talks about, we just need to reopen those verbal centers that have been shut down. We need to talk. We don't need to hear from Mr. Fix-It, right? What advice we need to solve our problems, which is the classic, you know, men are from Mars, women are from Venus approach. We want to have people hear us. They want to fix their problems, and we have a different approach. But this is even woman to woman. Right? Very often, we find ourselves relating back to ourselves. And that's natural. As human beings, we focus a lot on ourselves. Yet, what is her name? I don't even have it here. I apologize. What the author of the article claims is that sometimes the best answer, right, when we feel so compelled to give an answer to our, or a response to our friend who's crying on our shoulder, sometimes the best answer is no answer. Right? Just saying, I know, or I can't even imagine what that's like, or wow, can't believe it. And that's really all they need to hear, right? I think was interesting in what she said was that the version of empathy, which is, I know just how you feel and I can prove it, is different from the version of empathy that is, wow, that's really tough, right? I totally feel your pain. So I thought that was really interesting. And Stephen Covey, who wrote Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, is more of a business managerial position kind of manual. But I remember being recommended to read it by actually my Masada Kedushin, Rav Isaacson, if anyone has a Ksanim of Aseret. And that's where my husband went also. And he and his wife were like majorly into the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And I didn't read it at the time, but I read it, I don't know, several years ago. And I found it to be pretty applicable to everyday life, which is why they recommend it. It's applicable to relationships, not just to businesses. And what he says is that unfortunately, and if you look at the two quotes I have on the bottom of the page there, or towards the middle of the page on the back, most people do not listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply. And it's something that we don't even think about, and I don't even know if she focused on this so much. I think what the Reader's Digest article focuses on is how the person feels when we respond and just relate it to ourselves. What Stephen Covey adds is that when we're listening, just trying to formulate what we're going to say next, are we really listening? Are we really genuinely internalizing everything they're saying, or are we picking apart different various things that they're saying that apply to us so that we can figure out how to respond? Right? So I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind also, is that genuine listening is not just coming up with how to respond, but it's really taking in what they mean, what our friend is trying to tell us, what our spouse, right, is coming home from his day and you know, explaining to us. And instead of trying to respond, we should try to understand, right? Look at his next piece of advice. Seek first to understand, then to be understood. First, we have to understand what the other person's saying. Only then do we have a chance to say what we're saying, right? To relate it to ourselves or maybe even not. I mean, he's, again, doing this in like a negotiating standpoint. First, understand what the other side is trying to offer you. Only then can you try to tell them what your side wants, right? And that's a negotiation, but I think here it's important also, if we first seek to understand what our friend is saying, what our spouse is saying, what our kid is saying, then we can respond much more effectively, and hopefully they'll understand what we're trying to say. This is something, a concept that has, in modern day language or semantics, been called active listening. Has anyone ever heard of active listening? Right? If you do like a brief Google search, we'll tell you how strong a modern value this idea of active listening has become. This idea that we can't just, you know, listen in one ear, you know, goes out the other. We like pretend that we're hearing, but we're on our phone, right? Like there are so many ways that we listen in today's day and age where we're really distracted. We're not really fully paying attention. And that could be either because we're paying attention to something else or because we're paying attention to what we're going to say in response. But either way, we're not engaging in what's known as active listening. What I found really fascinating, and to quote Rabbi Yudin in Fairlawn, we got it first, right? Dr. Thomas Gordon is credited with developing this concept of active listening with his research in like the 1960s, 1970s. And yet, if we look back in our own traditions, if we look back in our own sources, we find that Judaism really picked up on the value of active listening way before Dr. Thomas Gordon had to figure it out through all these different studies that he performed. And so the first source that I'd like to see inside is in source number 2 in Yeshayahu. I actually just finished teaching this to my 10th graders. In Yeshayahu Perek Vav, we actually are given Yeshayahu's Nivuat HaKtasham, which is his introductory Nivuah, the first time that Hashem ever appears to him. And it comes along with his entire, you know, vision of Hashem and these Malachim, and etc. And it ends with his mission. And, you know, we discussed before we get to this HaKtasham, what is the role of a Navi? Right, the role of a Navi is really to inspire the people, to get them to change, to get them to do tshuva, to stop accepting the status quo and to try to become better people. That's the role of a Navi. That's why every single Navi was sent to the Jewish people by Hashem. And yet, Yeshayahu's mission seems to turn that completely on its head. What does Hashem tell him is his goal? Vayomer, lech ve'amarta la'am hazeh. Hashem says, I want you to go to the people and tell them, shim'u shamoa ve'al tavinu. Re'u ra'o. I want you to listen and not understand. I want you to see and not know. This seems shocking. This seems to be the opposite of the role of the Navi. Yeshayahu is supposed to go to the people and tell them to hear all the Nevuahs, all the Nadim's words, all the Torah's words, and not understand them? They're supposed to see all of Hashem's miracles, as Rashi explains, and not really know God? Is that really the role of a Navi? That question aside, what I find fascinating about this source is that it helps us understand that Hashem, Judaism, appreciates the difference between hearing, on the one hand, and understanding, on the other hand. We can hear lots of things. Right? How many times have we just read something because we had to, but we didn't understand a clue? We don't have a clue what we just said, right? Or we heard something, and we totally didn't even try to internalize it. That's shim u'shamala. That's hearing. Tavinu, lahavin, to understand, to internalize, that's something different. That takes an extra step. That takes more effort. And here already we see this differentiation between shmia and havana, between hearing and understanding. Because Hashem tells Yeshayahu to tell them specifically, listen and don't understand. You can hear something and you cannot understand it. That is possible. And so already we see this differentiation between hearing and understanding. The Ibn Ezra furthers this explanation, this understanding of the difference in source number 3. And this is actually when Moshe is complaining on Har Sinai at the Sneh, and he tells Hashem, I don't want to go. And he tells Hashem 5 times that he doesn't want to be his Navi. And 5 times Hashem reassures him. And one of the times he complains, actually, this is probably when Hashem is just describing what he's going to do with Paro, that he's going to ask Paro to have Bnei Yisrael leave, and Paro's not going to listen to him. And there the Ibn Ezra explains, Vishamu, Kol Shama, source number 3, Kol Shama Acharav Lamed Obed. Every time we see the shorish of Shin Mem Ayin, and it's followed by a Lamed or a Bet, meaning to hear to, or to hear in, Hatam, the meaning of that phrase is Sheishmeu Ha'inyan Shenosei HaKol Lo Lishmoa HaKol. What does this mean? It means that you should hear the topic that's being voiced, not just that you're hearing the voice. So here, the Ibn Ezra is differentiating between hearing, right? We can hear the vibrations that the voice brings to the air and gets into our ear, and that's the whole, right, sense of hearing. But no, that's not what Shama Lit or Shama Bit means. To really Shama Bit or Lit, to really, really get to the bottom of something, it means that you're really, we would differentiate it between hearing and listening. You're listening to what is being spoken about. You're not just hearing the voice, right? You're not just hearing the person talk, but you're hearing what they're saying. You're internalizing what they're saying. And so Judaism really affirms this idea, you know, in active listening, that we can't just hear, we have to listen. We have to actively seek to understand what's being said. We also see that Judaism has, way before the 1960s, told us that there is a value to making sure we can listen by creating an environment that is conducive to it. Right? If you go to source number 4 in Sefer Devarim, Moshe is speaking to Bnei Yisrael and says, if you go to the underline, Haskeit u'shema Yisrael, hayom hazah niyeta la'am la'Hashem alokacha. Haskeit, which is hard to understand, although the English translation here says, keep silent. Keep silent and hear, Bnei Yisrael, because now you have become Hashem's nation. And Rav Hirsch explains, what does this random word of haskeit mean? In source number 5, it means lahafnot et kol hamachshava v'nesima mesuyamet, to focus all of our attention to one thing. Haskeit more al tsumat lev drucha below kol hasechadat, paying attention without any distractions. Right, so another step of active listening that we're taught about is that we have to make sure that the environment is conducive to really, truly listening. We have to make sure that there are no distractions, right? Putting our phone in another room, right? Shutting off the phone or the house phone or ignoring it, right? There are different ways, right? Going to another room so that other people aren't milling about. There are so many ways to set up the situation, to set up the context to make sure that there are no distractions. Another thing that I think is brilliant, something that Shlomo HaMelech, again, the most brilliant man of all time, tells us in Sefer Mishlei, is exactly what basically what Stephen Covey and the London Ear article are telling us. And again, this is, you know, thousands of years before these were written up. I just think it's so cool. So in Mishlei Perek Yilchet Pasuk Bet, Lo Yachpotz Kesil Bitzvuna, a fool doesn't have any interest in understanding, Ki Im Behitgalot Libo. Rather, what is his interest? In revealing his heart. Meaning, he doesn't listen with the intent to understand. He listens with the intent to reply. And who is that person according to Shlomo HaMelech? A kasil, a fool. A fool is one who only wants to answer and hear his own voice and doesn't really want to hear what anyone else is saying. And he says it in Pasuk Gimel, in the same parak, Meshiv davar b'terem yishma, ivelet hilo uchlima. Someone who answers before truly hearing, it is folly and confusion for him, right? It is obviously very negative. Again, Shlomo HaMelech is getting to the heart of the matter that Stephen Covey and the Lens and Ear article are telling us, which is that if we're trying to just formulate our answers while we're listening, we're not going to help anybody. We're just going to help ourselves, right? We're that fool who's being selfish. No, a really wise person is much more interested in hearing what their friend has to say than in hearing what they themselves have to say in response. And finally, the Shemi Shmuel explains in his essays on Shavuos, "Bichush hashmiya shenaaseh gam kein chibur bein hashomea v'hamashmiya." What does true listening produce? It produces a connection between the listener and the talker and the speaker. Mitkarev u'mitchaber hamashmiya l'shomea. It creates this connection between he who is speaking and he who is listening, in a way that nothing else can, right? It's true listening that creates this connection. And what I think is fascinating is that we see these values not just in these, like, you know, little snippets of Parshanut or Psukim, but we really see the value of active listening come to the fore in three totally separate stories, two of which appear in Tanakh and one of which appears in the Gemara. The first story that I want to focus on is appears in Melachim Aleph Perek Gimel, not surprisingly, to Shlomo HaMelech himself. And this is even before he becomes the wisest man in the world, because it's the story in which he requests that wisdom. Right? The famous story where Hashem appears to him almost like the genie in Aladdin, right? You have three wishes, says the genie. Well, Hashem gives him one. And he says, you can have anything in the world. You've just become king. David HaMelech has just died. Shlomo HaMelech is a brand new king. And Hashem appears to him in a dream and says, what do you want? You can have anything. Shlomo HaMelech could have asked for wealth. He could have asked for honor. He could have asked for stature. He could have asked to be the best king in the world. That's not what he asked for. What does he ask for? Do you guys know what he asked for? Good. Wisdom. Yeah. And it's fascinating to see how Shlomo HaMelech, even before he gets that brilliance, phrases his request. If you turn the page to Pasuk Tet, he first starts, by the way, with praising Hashem for how amazing he is, which is something that he probably learned from Moshe Rabbeinu and Parshat Ve'echanan, and something that we model our Shemona Esrei after. We always praise Hashem before we request something. The Kli Yakar explains it's not to butter him up or to kiss up to Hashem, because he doesn't need that. It's more to remind ourselves that he is the source of everything. We can only ask him because he is so great, and to also humble ourselves that we are nothing without him. That's just aside. So in Pasuk Tet, what does Shlomo ask for? V'natata la'avdecha lev shomea. Please, Hashem, give your servant a listening heart. If you and I would have asked for a listening skill, what organ would we have chosen to describe a listening ear? Right? Lens and ear. We listen with our ears. We hear with our ears. We all know that. So why does Shlomo HaMelech ask for a listening heart?
Understand.
Especially in the times of Tanakh, the lev was actually where they believed was the seat of understanding, of thoughts. They actually kind of flipped the heart and the brain with what we know it today. The heart was thought to be the seat of logic, and the head was thought to be the seat of emotion, which is interesting. It's the opposite today. But a lev shomea really means that Shlomo understood that you don't just listen with your ear. If you only listened with your ear, that would be hearing, but it wouldn't really truly, right? To get to the heart of the matter that someone's talking about, we need to listen with our hearts. We need a lev shomea. It can't just end here, right? It has to get to our, and we would say it has to get into our brains. We have to internalize it. We have to truly understand it. And in fact, he continues, why does he want this lev shomea? Lishpot et amcha, so that I can judge your nation, because the primary role of a king is to pass judgment. Lehavin bein tov l'ra. And here Shlomo himself makes the connection between hearing, right? Between being a shomea and lehavin bein tov l'ra. He doesn't just want to hear. He wants to be a shomea so that he can understand, so that he can truly internalize with his lev what is needed from the nation. Which again, I think just foreshadows his ultimate brilliance and his writing in Sefer Mishlei. He obviously understood this concept very, very well. Right? He was obviously a smart guy before he even got his brilliance. You know, this is something that doesn't come as naturally to us human beings as one would hope. And so perhaps that's why Shlomo HaMelech was requesting it from Hashem. He knew that we tend to listen with our ears. So Shlomo HaMelech asked that it go beyond that, that he's able to listen with his heart, right, so that he can really, really, truly understand what he's hearing. Has anyone here ever heard of Sefer, or ever learned Sefer Iyov? Yeah, it's one of those, yeah, awesome. So it's one of those Sfarim that not, I mean, it's really not usually taught in school. Sometimes it's taught in seminary. Sometimes if, you know, you learn beyond, then you learn it. For those who don't have the background, if you don't mind, I'm just going to give you a slight background, because our second story is really premised on the understanding the whole story of Iyov. Iyov was a man who is described in the beginning of Sefer Iyov as a Yarei Shamayim, completely God-fearing, a tzaddik, someone who did everything well. He had a loving and wonderful family, and he had a lot of wealth. He basically had anything that anyone could ask for. And we're told later in that parak, it's a fascinating story, that Hashem has a meeting with the Malachim in Shemayim. He gathers all the angels around him, and the Satan's included, because he's one of them. And Hashem decides to, you know, open this meeting with, did you see Avdi Iyov? Did you see my servant Iyov? He is so amazing. He worships me. He is perfect. He's a tzaddik. And of course, the Satan pipes up and says, yeah, well, that's because he has everything he wants, right? Obviously, he would worship you and believe in you if he has everything, right? It's easy to believe in you have everything. And so Hashem gives, and this is in Sefer Iyov, Hashem gives the Satan permission to take everything away from Iyov except for his life. So we're told that the Satan goes down, he destroys his family, he takes away all of his wealth, he is stripped of everything but his own life and his wife's life. Interestingly, his wife responds to the entire thing, Hashem natan v'Hashem lakach, yihi shem Hashem mevorach. Hashem gave it to us in the first place, now he's taken it, he is blessed. And so we see that they really were from, like they were really, really, they had a lot of emunah. And yet you can imagine, Iyov has just lost his entire family, all of his kids, he's just lost all of his wealth, and he doesn't understand it, because he knows that he was a tzaddik. He knows that he worshipped God perfectly. Why would he deserve this? Why would this happen to him? Right? Maybe this can happen as a punishment for someone who did something wrong, but he knows he didn't do anything wrong. And so Iyov is sitting there extremely depressed, traumatized, obviously, not really understanding what happened, how it happened, and obviously why. And so three of his friends come to comfort him. And we're told, and this is where Iyov gets extremely difficult, because we're told that Iyov has this extremely long speech to his friends, proclaiming his innocence, and expressing his utter disbelief and lack of understanding of what happened to him. And his friends, in turn, each give him a response. Again, extremely flowery. And their response, all of their responses, is basically, in different words, Iyov, you must have done something wrong. If you got so punished, if something so terrible happened to you, there must be something, even if you don't know what it was, you must have done something wrong for Hashem to punish you. And this goes on and on and on. Iyov tells him he's innocent. They tell him he must be guilty. And it happens for, I mean, there are at least three times that Iyov speaks and they counter him. What's interesting is that we know at a certain point, a fourth friend, whose name is Elihu, comes to join the party. At the very, very end of the Sefer, after listening to all the friends, he does join in and, you know, respond to Iyov as well. At the very, very end of the Sefer, Hashem gives us his summary of his view of these friends. If you look in source number 9, Hashem presents himself to Iyov and his whole approach, and we can discuss that at the end. After Hashem said everything he wanted to say to Iyov, El Iyov, Vayomar Hashem El Eliphaz HaTemani. Hashem talks now, he faces one of Iyov's friends, Eliphaz. Chara apibacha uvishnei reyacha. I am angry with you and with your two friends. Ki lo dibartim elai nechonaka avdi Iyov. Because you're wrong, and he's right. Notice who is not mentioned there in the rebuke? The fourth friend, Elihu. So Hashem here rebukes the first three friends but doesn't rebuke Elihu. Now, this is all the more surprising because when Elihu speaks, he doesn't really seem to say anything that's really different from the first three friends. He also seems to repeat himself. Even though he claims he's going to do something differently, he really just says the same thing. So the major question that arises is, well, why is Elihu not rebuked like the other three friends if he didn't really seem to say anything differently? And I believe that the answer is in source number 10. If we turn back 10 prakim, to an, we're told that Elihu first comes. What are we told? We're told in Pasuk Bet, Vayichar af Elihu ben Barach al Habuzi mimishpachat Ram bi'iyuv, chara apo al tiko nafsho melokim. We're told that Elihu was very angry with Iyov and what he was saying. Ubishlosha re'al chara apo al asher lomatz umeyanam mivayarshiu et Iyov. And he was also angry at the three friends because they didn't find a way to really answer Iyov. They just tried to find fault in Iyov. What is unique about Elihu? He did not think he was going to talk. He was waiting. Why didn't he partake in the conversation? Because they were older than him. And especially in antiquity, you didn't speak before your elders. He had come in to comfort Eov, but there were three older men. And so he came with the purpose of listening, with the purpose of hearing what the conversation was going to be about. He had no intention to reply or respond because they were older than him. But at a certain point, Pasuk Hey, Vayara Elihu ki ein ma'aneh b'fi shloshet ha'anashim v'yicharapo. At a certain point, he saw these friends are not doing it. They may be older than me, but they are totally failing in their role. V'ya'an Elihu ben Barach al Habuzi v'yomer. And so he responds. What's the difference between Elihu and the other three friends? Not in their responses, because if you follow his response, like I said, it's the same thing, rehashed. The only difference is he was listening with the intent to understand, not with the intent to reply. And I believe that is why Hashem did not rebuke him the way that he rebuked the other three friends. He wasn't saying that he got it right. He never praised Elihu for getting it right. He didn't. Only Hashem got it right at the end of the Sefer. But he acknowledged that Elihu at least listened. True active listening was only done by Elihu. What was Hashem's answer, by the way, just not to leave you hanging? Hashem's answer is basically, Iyov, you can't understand me. You think that everything happens for a reason. Well, we know that. But you think that everything has to happen in a very linear and clear way. Right? I was just teaching your girls this like the past week with Eliyahu. Right? If you sin, you get punished. And if you do mitzvah, you're rewarded. And therefore, if you're punished, what must have happened? You sinned. So Eob couldn't understand it because he knows he didn't sin. The friends just assumed that he must have sinned because that would make it very clear and linear. Well, Hashem appears to him in a whirlwind, which goes in a circular fashion, showing Eob that not everything is linear. Not everything is clear-cut. Din is clear-cut. If everything was based on din in this world, everything would be just as we said. You sin, you get punished. You do good, you get rewarded. But Hashem added the element of rachamim. Right, we had the Yugamu Midot Rachman, which I spoke about in Elo. Right, we had this idea that not everyone who does bad is going to get punished necessarily. Hashem will delay his anger. He may not punish. So we have the idea of Rasha V'Tovlo. Sometimes there are people who do bad and things, and he does well in life. On the flip side, because of the institution of Rachamim, we also get Tzadik V'Ralo, someone who doesn't do anything wrong and yet experiences terrible things. And so what Hashem tells Eov essentially is that things are not clear. You cannot understand my ways. Because Rachamim kind of muddies it all up. Muddies the waters, right? Din is very clear. Rachamim makes everything confusing. That's the source, by the way, of Tzadik V'Ralo and Rasha V'Tovlo. Many say the source is in Eov because he's a classic example of Tzadik V'Ralo and he doesn't understand and Hashem says, yeah, you won't. That's our answer. The third and last story actually appears in the Gemara in Eruvin. And many of us know that there were many, many, many disagreements between Shammai and Hillel. And that after they died, their students continued those disagreements, right? Hanukkah's coming up, right? Classic machloket on Hanukkah is that Shammai believed that on the first night you light 8 candles, and then you light 7, 6, until you get to 1. Hillel believes that, no, you start with 1, and then you build up to 8. Classic machloket. And who do we practice like? Hillel. Right? Well, the source of that is in the Gemara in Erevin, in source number 11. Amar Rabbi Abba, Amar Shmuel. Shalosh Shanim Nechleku Beit Shammai Uveit Hillel. For 3 years, the students of Hillel and Shammai argued with each other. Halalu Omrim Halacha Kimoteinu, Halalu Omrim Halacha Kimoteinu. Each claiming that the halacha is really like that. And I'm right, you're wrong. Yatza Barkol Ve'amra. Finally, a heavenly voice comes out of the heavens and says, Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim. Hain, both these and these, Divrei Beit Shammai and Divrei Beit Hillel, both opinions are correct. They're both the words of the living God. Okay, but we can't really light 8 candles and 1 candle at the same time, so what do we do if they're both correct? V'halacha k'Beit Hillel. But we paskin, at least in this world, right, before Mashiach, according to some, we'll switch to Shammai's opinions during Yimon HaMashiach, but the Gemara says here, V'halacha k'Beit Hillel, we paskin like Hillel. Okay. But then the Gemara asked the obvious question. If the Bakol came out and told us that they're both correct, both opinions are true, why did Hillel win out in terms of practice? Why do we practice like him? Why not practice like Beit Shammai? So the Gemara answers beautifully. Mipnei shel nochin ve'aluvin hayu. Because Beit Hillel was nicer. Vishonin divrehen vidivrei by Shammai. What did Hillel do? Well, what did Shammai do? Shammai said, we're right and this is our opinion. Beit Hillel said, this is our opinion and this is Beit Shammai's opinion. Velo od, ela shemagdimin divrei by Shammai ledivrehen. That's actually not how they did it. They said, by the way, this is Beit Shammai's opinion and this is our opinion. What did they do? They listened to the other side. Beit Shammai said their opinion. They couldn't care less what Beit Hillel had to say. They arrived at their conclusion and they told everyone what it was. Beit Hillel, on the other hand, listened to Beit Shammai's opinion first. They internalized it. They analyzed it. They argued about it within themselves. They tried to figure out, is it right, is it wrong? And then they arrived at their own different conclusion. And they said it afterwards. They listened with the intent to understand, not with the intent to reply. And I believe, based on everything that we've said, and based on all the values in Judaism, in Tanakh, in Gemara, in Chazal, and everything that we've seen about the value of active listening, that is why Beit Hillel was zocha to have his opinion practiced. Because he demonstrated active listening. He demonstrated that he really understood Beit Shammai's opinion, and yet still arrived at a different conclusion. And because of this active listening, because of this listening with the intent to understand and not with the intent to reply, Beit Hillel was zocha to have their opinion followed. How can we apply this to our own lives? So I think that the last source, which is the Gra, boils it down very clearly for us. The Gra, the Vilna Gaon, a genius of his own right, commenting on Mishlei, says as follows. He says, he's commenting on a pasuk that says, Shim'u banim musar av. And he tells us in source number 12, Shim'u mishamesh legimel lishonot. The phrase, the shorash of shama, the word in Hebrew shama, really means 3 different things. Ha'alef lashon kabbalah. The first is the language of acceptance. It means to accept what the other person's saying. And he brings a proof. We're going to move on to the next one, the next line. Ha'bet lashon havana. The second way to understand the shorash of shama is that it means to understand. Beginning of the third line, the hagimel, hu lashon shmiya kimashma'o. And the third is literally to hear. Bless you. Rabbi Noach Orlowick, has anyone ever heard of his book, Raising Roses Among the Thorns? He wrote a book on chinuch, on raising children, called Raising Roses Among the Thorns. And he explains that better communication stems from these 3 facets of hearing. He kind of does it in the opposite order. He says the first is physical hearing, right? Shmiya kemashma'o, as the Gra explains last. You just have to make sure that you're in an appropriate setting in which to hear the other person, right? So that means a quiet room. That means no distractions, things that we were talking about before. It means setting up the situation so that you can actually hear what the other person's saying, without getting caught up in other things, without having a booming voice on the other side of the wall, distract you from what's being said. Right? Not like speaking to a friend while you're on Facebook or G-chatting, right? You have to make sure to kind of really pay attention. Number 2, which is, again, the gross second, is lashon havana. is understanding. And this is where we have his response of paying attention without trying to formulate a reply, right? Really, really listening and trying to understand what the person's saying without trying to relate it back to ourselves, without trying to figure out what we're going to say in response. Also, he adds to pay attention to what's not said, right? Which is really important and sometimes harder to really pay attention to. And number three, he said, is Lashon Kabbalah, is acceptance. Accepting that what the other person is saying is how they feel, even if we don't agree with it. Even if we say, you shouldn't be embarrassed by that, that was stupid, or who cares? Or that was a stupid thing for them to say, they don't know what they're talking about. If the person speaking to us is embarrassed, is upset, does feel that it's the end of the world, accepting that and validating that. That's the only way that they'll feel that they've really been heard. And so I hope that we will all be able to apply this Jewish value that has become a modern secular one of active listening to really enable us to connect to all those around us more deeply and more Jewishly. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
So you guys can keep anything, and anything you don't want to keep, I'm happy to take. What do you say?
I sent that one back to the iPad. We don't want to keep it.
Sure, please. You can keep the article, the sources. I can take both, either.
It can't be that old of an article because they said it's like emotional attention deficit disorder.
Yes.
So.
It could have been from the year 2009. It might have been from the late 90s. You know, I don't think it was earlier than that.
But
it was
back in the
90s. Yeah, it was. I think it was. Well, the fact that she calls it an emotional attention deficit disorder.
It means that attention deficit disorder was a thing already.
But it also means that it wasn't emotional yet, and now it is. So she is dating herself, because having emotional attention deficit disorder today is just having ADD. But it's, you know, she's definitely dating herself, but yes, it can't be too far back. No, no. I don't even remember if someone gave it to me, if I found it randomly. I have no idea.
I kept it. Yeah.
But I don't have my original. I searched for it online, and it was online. I think I knew the title of it because I quoted it in my notes, so I knew it was called Lend an Ear, and I found it. The truth is, I could Google it and probably find out what year it was published.
Right.
And the author that's not on here. Google's amazing. It really does. Especially when you know, from like ordering pizza to like really deep things, even Jewish things. I find so many things on Google, for sure. Oh yeah, it's amazing.
Is Rabbi Isaacson, is that Mrs. Isaacson?
Husband, yes.
Nina actually just stayed at her house this past.
Oh, that's so cute. So was him.
Right, but she was. They weren't there.
Oh, she babysat.
No.
Okay.
Lerner was having a Shabbat.
Oh, so they stayed at the house. That's so cute.
Right, and they
so they used the house.
She's saying it's a really big house.
Well, they have like 7 or 9 kids.
Right. Well, that
yeah.
was
and he was a very successful
Nobody
lawyer.
He was a very successful lawyer.
Actually, when we were getting married, he would still come back for 2 weeks in the summer and work for some law practice. No. He was back when we met with him. No, we flew him in for the wedding because it was in September. But he was back in like August or July, so we had like our pre-marriage meeting with him then.
No, it was very funny. It was like they all had to find places to stay, and like she was not home. I guess I should have one married kid who was staying here. She was like, you know, 7 girls that could stay at the house. And then they were like, they're thinking like,
So he's Rosh Hashiva now, and she's administrated. He's Rosh Hashiva and Vassara. Yeah, I mean, Lisa would know better than me, but when Aaron was there, he was his Ram, but then he became the Rosh Hashiva. When Rav Berzon left, he got promoted. Rav Berzon. Not Rav Yudhaya, his uncle, Rav Azaria. He's still there. But he has never been Rosh Hashiva. He was like director of like operations. So his uncle founded it. But he left. Okay, did I get everything? Thank you so much for coming.
Did you know that they live right next door to each other? Isaacson's and Lerner?
No, I never went to any of their houses. Just randomly, I just never went.
I'm just hung up on the day out of this house.
Thank you. This is great. I hung up on the day out of this house. Not necessarily.
There's time for everything.
We look at their shoulders. Their shoulders are self-centered. Yeah. So I think it depends. I think it depends on the situation.
Because I was answering Amanda, but I was like, I'm so sorry. And like, you're not so right.
Right.
He was really just working, so he had no time to talk.
Right, exactly.
So, it was still better. Thank you. Really.
Can we drive Mario?
Yeah,
I think I have room in my car.
Don't worry.
Sorry, I drove up here, but I have
room
in my
parents. Oh, sure.
Can you somebody
I can take you to? Jessica, do you live here?
Do I live?
Yeah, like, do you like...
We were talking about you, by the way.
Oh.
I mean, we haven't seen you forever.
We haven't been around.
Clearly.
We're back.
We missed you every week.
How long?
Classic.
You missed us. What?
My French here.
Oh, yeah, you missed. I know, I missed that. I missed the previous one. We missed the KJ dinner.
Yes,
I know, we missed a lot.
Are you here now for a while or not?
I'm here for like 2.5 weeks. And
we haven't been in Florida.
Now we're going to Florida. Connie's going to be home. Then we're going to Florida to visit my parents. Then we're coming back for a little bit. Then we're going back to Israel at the end of January.
How's she doing?
How is which one?
Nina and Nathalie.
Good. Yeah, they're
all there.
They're
all
there. They go there and
together.
I was
on the edge here.
I got nobody here, so.
Right. You have us. You have Kimball.
How is
Rachel's
doing a little better, thank God. She got a job tutoring now, which is good, like once a week. So that's like perfect,
that's
and like
great.
She has a little bit more.
Welcome. What does she do with the baby? With the Hila?
So it actually works out at the same time that somebody from Dark Athena is coming with us anyway. So it was perfect. Yeah.
That's
ready?
Amazing.
That's awesome. That's perfect.
I'm going to watch her.
This is cool.
I've never seen these.